Welcome to the Exhale Podcast, a candid conversation about current matters relating to respiratory diagnostic and lung health. Today's hosts are Mark Russell, Marketing Communications Manager, and Troy Pridgen, Executive Vice President of Sales and Operations for Vitalograph in North America, a global leader in respiratory diagnostics. Today, we talk with Rory Chan. He's a senior respiratory registrar currently working in the Nine Wells Hospital in Dundee, United Kingdom. Our topic today is how precision medicine can help with accurate diagnosis in severe asthma.
Dr. Chan, hey, welcome to our podcast.
Hi, thank you very much, Mark, for having me here today.
Tell us about yourself, background, education, and your current responsibilities.
So I'm currently a senior respiratory registrar, so I'm in my final year of kind of higher specialist training in Dundee in Scotland in the UK. And my main sort of responsibilities include looking after patients on the ward, mainly respiratory and general medical patients, so internal medicine. I have recently completed a PhD relating to precision medicine and severe asthma, and have also published a number of peer-reviewed papers in various journals. Otherwise, I'm also affiliated with the University of Dundee as an honorary clinical lecturer, and also I do some work with Chest Journal as an early career editor as well.
Excellent. Thank you for that. I was intrigued. I noticed you used the word precision medicine. Can you tell us what you mean by precision medicine and what are some of the benefits and challenges of the approach?
Yeah, exactly. So it seems to be the hot topic of the current decade, isn't it, precision medicine? But essentially, the term refers to collecting a wide array of data, including clinical, biomarker, genetic, even lifestyle data, with the ultimate aim to sort of optimize patient outcomes, and generally contrasts the more sort of conventional and less precise one-size-fits-all approach in medicine. I think traditionally, when it relates to asthma, which is my area of interest, clinicians have traditionally used an escalating combination of inhaled corticosteroids, long-acting beta agonists such as bronchodilators and leukotriene receptor antagonists and even theophylline to treat patients. But this is not really according to their phenotype. It's more according to their disease severity. So I think the identification of so-called treatable traits has been shown to improve patient outcomes. And for example, Vanessa McDonald published a very nice paper a few years ago in the European Respiratory Journal, where she enrolled a number of severe asthmatic patients, split them into two groups, and identified a number of treatable traits in each patient. And I think the mean number of treatable traits in each patient was about 10 or so. And you can split these traits into pulmonary, extrapulmonary, and even behavioral factors. And for example, pulmonary factors would include airflow limitation or inflammation even. Extrapulmonary refers to more things that are outside the lungs, such as anemia or obesity, for instance. And then finally, behavioral factors include sort of smoking and exercise tolerance as well. So you can go quite deep with treatable traits and what you conclude in essence with regards to what constitutes a treatable trait. But essentially, she took those two groups and used a conventional approach versus a treatable traits, specifically targeting those traits approach. And what she found was those patients actually did a lot better in terms of both asthma quality of life and also asthma control. So I think this is probably the way we're heading towards with regards to precision medicine, in at least in severe asthma.
So Dr. Chan, what sorts of challenges are there in treating patients with severe asthma?
Yeah, this is a really good question. So I think at the moment, because severe asthma is such a heterogeneous condition, it can present in various ways. And I think the first thing is always to try and diagnose severe asthma. And I think one of the major problems is underdiagnosing severe asthma. And if patients present with an over-reliance of reliever therapies, such as short-acting beta agonists, then they can sometimes fly under the radar because we're just using the beta agonist as a sort of safety blanket. And similarly, if patients come in having required two or three courses of oral corticosteroids and they present to their doctor with seemingly good control, it can sometimes mask the underlying problem. So I think, first of all, we need to diagnose severe asthma more. And I think underdiagnosis is certainly a problem. I think linked to that is I think clinicians generally have been quite reactive in the sense that we are making decisions surrounding biologic therapy. So that's the new agents such as benralizumab, dupilumab, and tezepelumab. Those decisions are typically made after patients have experienced multiple severe exacerbations requiring oral corticosteroids or even hospital admissions or even ICU admissions. I think this is suboptimal because exacerbations are known to be linked to lung function decline. And we know cumulative oral corticosteroid exposure is also associated with significant long-term complications that can include osteoporosis, sepsis, and even death, unfortunately. I think moving on from this, maybe we might wish to take a more proactive approach by predicting patients who are at risk of severe asthma exacerbations and try and treat them and prevent them from having critical exacerbations. And I think this requires the practicing of precision medicine.
Yeah, you bring up a good point. The stakes are quite high. And my understanding is only about 30% of asthma diagnoses are even made at this point with spirometry testing. What do you consider to be the key information for accurate diagnosis in the case of severe asthma? What parameters are particularly informative?
That is a very good question, but very difficult question to answer as well, because at the moment we don't really have a specific gold standard test to diagnose asthma. When you look at the Global Initiative for Asthma Guidelines, that's the GINA Global Asthma Guidelines, they usually recommend using a number of investigations, including spirometry and also FeNO testing, for instance, as well as blood eosinophils. And each part of the testing becomes a jigsaw puzzle that we can add together for a definitive diagnosis or at least increase the likelihood of asthma. I think probably the starting point for an accurate diagnosis in severe asthma would be to go back to the history and try and ascertain if there are any triggers, whether that's medication, viral triggers, or even allergies, for instance, and also detect if there are any other clinical features that might point towards other diagnosis. For instance, if there's a heavy smoking history, then perhaps chronic obstructive pulmonary disease might be more of a realistic diagnosis. If patients have paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea, for example, then perhaps we should be thinking about heart failure. So we do need to have a kind of a holistic approach, at least to try and rule out other diagnosis. And in some ways, severe asthma is almost a diagnosis of exclusion. So after excluding other respiratory diagnoses, then we think about asthma.
So what are the top tips that you would share for using spirometry, oscillometry, FeNO in a clinic testing?
Yeah, good question. So I think for spirometry, there are established guidelines. The American Thoracic Society guidelines have very good recommendations. And I think the first thing for at least spirometry would be to ensure that their values that are obtained are by trained personnel, whether that's lung function clinicians or people who do lung function testing quite regularly and using machines that have been properly calibrated, essentially looking at acceptability, usability, and also repeatability criteria. And just as an example, for instance, simple things like patients should not be coughing in the first second of expiration for FEV1 and also for FEC. So that's forced expiratory volume in 1 second and forced vital capacity. And those are simple things that can be done to ensure that, you know, values are repeatable, not only between centres, but also between sessions for the same patient as well. And for instance, an easy to do repeatability criteria would be to ensure the largest two FEV1 values are at least within 150 millilitres of each other. So that would be for spirometry, for instance. I guess for oscillometry, then there are a lot of issues as well, but oscillometry has the advantage of being a lot more physiological in terms of only asking patients to perform tidal breathing. So it reflects real life lung physiology a lot more than spirometry. And in some ways that is easier, but also ensuring that nose clips are in place at all times, similar to spirometry. Placing your hands on your cheeks as well is another important thing, and sitting upright. So these are all little things that can be done to improve the repeatability and more reliability of these tests. So I think that's probably a starting point.
Let me come back and ask you, you didn't say anything about FeNO.
So FeNO, so patients do need to have a specific expiratory flow rate for FeNO. So I do remember there was a patient who required 14 tries before managing FeNO. So I think from my point of view, that was a learning point for me as well. I think just making sure the person who's doing the tests have a bit of patience as well, because quite often when someone comes to the clinic, we see them and, you know, the patient wasn't able to perform FeNO, but it doesn't really mention how many tries it was done to try and obtain those values. But I think my maximum is 14 for someone with severe asthma. And I guess when we compare FeNO and spirometry to oscillometry, I think both spirometry and FeNO require patients to perform a specific maneuver. In spirometry, it's forced, and in FeNO, it's more trying to maintain that steady flow rate for, you know, 10 seconds, whereas oscillometry is just tidal breathing, so it's a lot easier. But they all have their individual nuances. So if patients aren't able to breathe out for a long period of time, so almost about 10 seconds, then I think they might struggle with FeNO. So I think it's just plenty of encouragement, similar to in spirometry, and plenty of patient coaching as well.
Excellent. Thank you for that. There are a lot of terms that we're using right now with spirometry, oscillometry, FeNO. Can you kind of give us a bit more of a breakdown on what those different procedures tell us relative to each other and why the one might be more preferable than another?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very interesting area at the moment. So spirometry essentially measures the forced expiratory volume in 1 second. So it can give you dynamic lung volumes and give us a lot of information about how good a patient's lung function is. So FEV1 stands for forced expiratory volume in 1 second. And usually, although we can calculate Z-scores, usually we use a predicted value based on their age, their height, and even their ethnicity. So anything above 80% predicted for their specific makeup would be considered as normal. Second interesting value would be forced vital capacity or vital capacity, and that just tells you the entire, so in simplistic term, that's the entire lung volume. And again, 80% predicted would be considered normal. And finally, we also include FEV1 over FVC ratio. So anything above 0.70 or 70% as a ratio of the two values would be considered normal. So spirometry is interesting when it comes to asthma, being that it can be normal in quite a lot of situations. So just because someone has normal spirometry, it doesn't necessarily mean they don't have asthma. And that just goes back to there being no single diagnostic or gold standard test for asthma, unfortunately. If you look between the lines, there's another value that sometimes can tell us a bit more information about the small airways, and that's FEF 25 to 75, and that's the forced expiratory flow rate between 25 and 75% of the forced vital capacity or mid-expiratory flow. And that sometimes gives us an indication of the smaller airways, which are always also termed as the quiet zone of the lung. And the reason why it's the quiet zone is because typically inhalers or bronchodilating drugs, such as short-acting beta agonists, struggle to penetrate the smaller airways of the lungs, and that's why it's called the quiet zone. And when it comes to oscillometry, we are looking at entirely different variables. So whereas spirometry looks at more lung volumes and airway obstruction, oscillometry looks at two parameters called resistance and reactance. Resistance can be measured at different frequencies. That's 5 hertz or 20 hertz. So typically, you know, smaller frequencies such as 5 hertz travel longer distances. So resistance at 5 hertz would be traveling all the way down to the small airways. So that's the entire, so resistance of the entire bronchial tree. Larger frequencies travel shorter distances. So resistance at 20 hertz refers to kind of the resistance at the larger airways. And if you subtract the two, then you do get the smaller airways. So what we mean by frequency dependent resistance is generally R5 minus R20, which is a bit of a mouthful. Reactance is a combination of both the inertive forces with also the lung compliance. So essentially we're looking at either reactance at 5 hertz, so that's low frequency reactance, or reactance over a range of frequencies, which can be considered as area under the reactance curve, or AX. But basically, both of those markers, so the R5 minus R20 looks at the small airway resistance, and AX looks at the compliance of the lung and tells us a bit more information. For example, we recently published a paper in European Respiratory Journal combining both the use of spirometry and oscillometry to identify patients with moderate to severe asthma better in terms of both identifying poor asthma control and also the risk of more exacerbations. So actually both spirometry and oscillometry have a synergistic additive effect rather than thinking about, oh, which one should I use? Perhaps we can use both of them synergistically. When we look at FeNO, depending on which guidelines you look at, provides you different cutoffs. So typically or traditionally, we've been using 25 parts per billion as a simplistic cutoff to define eosinophilic inflammation. And different guidelines, for example, NICE would use 40 parts per billion. And if you look at the ATS guidelines, sometimes we use 50 parts per billion, and different cutoffs again denote different things. But generally speaking, the higher the FeNO, the higher the likelihood of eosinophilic inflammation, thus more likely to be asthma, although again, there's no specific cutoff or definite diagnosis of asthma. Simon Couillard published a very nice paper in Thorax a couple of years ago, where he combined both fractional exhaled nitrate oxide, so FeNO, with the eosinophils to predict patients who were at higher risk of severe exacerbations. And this is across all severities of asthma, whether that's global initiative asthma, stage one, all the way down to stage five. So that was a very interesting paper.
So let's talk about barriers to testing, training, education on spirometry, FeNO, and oscillometry, the acceptance of test values and assessing equipment, which is more proven benefits to the patients.
Yeah, exactly. I think training and education will always be difficult when it comes to any equipment that we use. But I think the time spent on training and education definitely is worthwhile for, all of spirometry, FeNO, and oscillometry. I think the learning curve initially will be high, but as with everything, the more we do, the more mistakes we find, and the easier it becomes over time. And that's true for all three, spirometry, FeNO, or oscillometry. I think in terms of acceptance of test data values, I think spirometry has really well characterized reference values at the moment. Basically, the main reason for this being that spirometry has been around the longest and has been studied the most, I think. So from that point of view, it's fine. FeNO, I think, is more debated as we discussed, but generally it's accepted that 25 parts per billion is considered high. And that's where all the major phase three trials using biologics really looked at using that cut point as well. And 50 is considered very high. And again, that sort of cut point has been used in those phase three trials looking at biologics as well. I think the most difficult one would be oscillometry in terms of accepting test data value. And when you look at Gregory King's oscillometry technical standards published in ERJ a couple of years ago, it does mention some bronchodilator response values. So bronchodilator response values, just for people who are interested, refers to what it says on the tin, essentially. So the response to short-acting beta agonists. And depending on the protocol, typically we give 400 micrograms of salbutamol and we compare pre versus post spirometry, and anything that is traditionally 200 mils and 12%. Change in an FEV1 is considered positive for a bronchodilator response, and that increases the chances of this being asthma because it's reversible disease. But for oscillometry at the moment, there's no specific considered bronchodilator response cut point. And similarly for any of the other markers such as R5 minus R20 or AX, there's no specific cut points. Our group has tried to make a cut point in terms of looking at cut points that would indicate patients are at higher risk of exacerbations and asthma symptom control. And those two variables are the most interesting in terms of to us as clinicians. And I think we have established that a cut point of R5 minus R20 of about 0.10 kilopascals per liter per second is indicative of small airway resistance. And similarly, an AX of about equal to or more than 1.0 kilopascals per liter is again indicative of lung stiffness as well. I think it was Foy's group publishing a very nice paper in 2018 in the Blue Journal, showing using computational modeling that an R5 minus R20 of 0.08 kilopascals per liter per second indicates severe small airway constriction. So the numbers are very similar in terms, and there's a lot of research going on at the moment. But I think this is definitely the area of interest that we have moving forward.
Well, do you think that a precision medicine approach might support better outcomes in other respiratory diseases as well as asthma?
Yeah, great question. So I think now that we've shown that, you know, precision medicine is important in improving outcomes in severe asthma, I think certainly in other respiratory diseases as well, I think all of these investigations possibly do have some value. I'm looking specifically at, I think spirometry, we already use quite a lot in different conditions such as COPD, cystic fibrosis, for instance. Oscillometry, very much less so, but I think based on the fact that oscillometry does detect significant, you know, small airways disease on top of spirometry, I would expect the small areas to be affected by other conditions such as interstitial lung disease and cystic fibrosis. And quite often, just because patients have normal spirometry, just like in asthma, it doesn't mean that they don't have any lung disease. Perhaps spirometry just isn't sensitive enough to pick this up. An example of precision medicine in thoracic oncology, for instance, would include patients who are quite often phenotyped in terms of their histopathology. For instance, the identification of programmed death ligands, so that PD-L1, resulted in development of immunotherapy agents such as nivolumab and pembrolizumab that have significantly improved survival compared to traditional chemotherapy. And another example would be, you know, in respiratory infectious diseases, you know, if we establish the causative organism, then that allows us to target antimicrobials and also sensitivities to that organism, whilst also mitigating the problem of drug resistance. So I think it is really important, and I think it is popping up in different areas of not only respiratory medicine, but medicine as a whole.
Dr. Chan, this has been just a wide awakening on this precision medicine. We really appreciate you being on our podcast. The information on this has been very enlightening. And I know Troy and I, every time we do these podcasts, we seem to learn something new every time.
I really appreciate you having me on, Mark, again. Thank you to you and Troy. It's always good to have a chat and talk about, you know, interesting things with like-minded people. So thank you.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Exhale Podcast. Don't forget to follow us for upcoming new episodes, and please take our survey to help provide good content for the future. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to you joining us again on the Exhale Podcast, brought to you by Vitalograph.